9/11 plus 15 today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Valerie Kaur was in college on September 11, 2001. After the attack, she quit school and became an activist. Now she documents hate crimes against Muslims and Sikhs.
Hate groups have increased by 14% for the first time in 5 years, and now we see candidates using Islamophobia as a political tool.
Plus, what it's like for a 10-year-old girl and her family in war-torn Yemen.
We all slept in one room in the basement, and our pack bags were ready. They had money, our passports, even if we knew that we can't travel.
And an Indian-American sees a bit of himself in Star Trek's Mr. Spock.
He was biracial, like me. You know, he was of two different cultures kind of being smashed together.
That's all coming up today here on The World. It's almost 15 years since 9/11. It may be cliche now to call it the day that changed everything, but for one specific group of people, 9/11 really did change everything. I'm talking about the men and women who decided to join the military in the aftermath of the attack. So ahead of Sunday's anniversary, we decided to check in with some of them to get their reflections on that day, their decision to join up, and what's happened since. Back then, Michelle Nicholson was in her 20s, an immigrant originally from South Africa. So you were a bit older than the average military recruit. What made you decide to enlist?
Well, certainly 9/11 was a underlying factor. After that happened, I felt very motivated to try and do something. I obviously had always been in service projects and philanthropy, and I looked at kind of where I was in life and what I was doing. And as a South African citizen and a green card holder, I decided to enlist in the U.S. Army. And I enlisted in September 2002. And I just felt very motivated to somehow help a country that had accepted me and embraced me and given me the opportunity to go to school and college. And I knew that this was the country that I was going to make home eventually and become a citizen. And I also, I don't know, I guess I had always seen myself as doing something bigger than myself. And the military certainly offers that to you. You become part of a larger family. You know, you do things you never thought you could do. And so it was overall a wonderful bonding experience. I've made lifelong friends through it and met my husband through it. So
that's great.
It's been a good experience.
You know, if we recall George W. Bush, president at the time with his megaphone at the World Trades atop that pile of rubble, there was a real sense of a need to retaliate. But you talk about service when you talk about why you joined the military.
Yes. I was not in combat arms when I joined, but I knew I was going to go to Iraq. But I wanted that option to be there to, A, help the people, and B, help my fellow citizens.
Yeah, you served a year in Iraq, mostly in the Green Zone, and I gather you found life there kind of familiar.
Well, yes, coming from South Africa, especially growing up in the late 80s and early 90s, there was a lot of civil unrest. And certainly the walls, the cordons, the checkpoints, it wasn't as militarized when I was growing up there, but certainly we dealt with state of emergencies on, I'd say, probably a monthly basis. When I moved to the States, we had a tornado drill, and I asked my teacher if we were having a terrorism drill at school, and they said, what? And I said, well, this is in 1995, and I said, well, this is what we do in South Africa. We have terrorism drills where we get under the desks, and I dealt with that since I was 6 years old, so... yes, it was familiar.
Michelle, looking back 15 years, do you think enlisting as a way to respond to 9/11 was the right thing to do?
For me, it certainly was. You know, I knew that I was going to deploy, whether it was to Afghanistan or to Iraq. I knew that this was something that personally spoke to me. And, you know, certainly when you look back, you don't want to think you wasted a year of your life doing something that was for naught. And so for me, I try and look at the positive things that happened, the, I guess, good influence that we had, the relationships that I was able to make with local Iraqis that worked with us.
You're a mother now. Have you thought about how, when the questions begin, you'll explain 9/11 to your kids and what you did afterwards?
That's a very hard question, Marco. you know, I think luckily they're 4 and 2, so right now I don't really have to go into.
You've got some time to think about it.
I have some time to think about it. But you know, obviously there were some people who felt very strongly that America, as an ideology and nation, was wrong in their eyes, and felt that the only way that they could make some kind of impact was through a very evil, very horrible, very huge terrorism attack. And it impacted the rest of the world and will impact the rest of the world for generations. And, you know, America as a country felt that retaliation at that time was the right thing to do. Looking back at it now, you know, people question it. You know, I'd like, my husband enlisted before 9/11, so his reasons for joining was very different than mine. But, you know, their daddy still has to go out every day and do the job of a soldier. And so, obviously, we are very pro-military. And, you know, we'd like them to think of their daddy as doing something by looking after, you know, doing a job as looking after the country.
Michelle Nicholson is an Iraq war veteran who enlisted after 9/11. Michelle, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Marco. I appreciate it.
Michelle was just one of thousands of young Americans who enlisted or reenlisted after the 9/11 attacks. We heard from many others, too, after reaching out to our online community of veterans. Many said things like, I felt the need to do my part, or I felt a sense of duty. And like Michelle, few had regrets about their personal choices, though plenty had concerns about the U.S. government's decision to invade Iraq or about the overall prosecution of the war. Jason Peterson joined the Air Force and ended up a captain. He served 9 years with tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, building bases, often under fire.
In 9/11, I was still in college. I was studying for my degree in civil engineering, and I was just getting ready to attend my morning classes when I heard the news.
Right. How did you respond?
As with most Americans, I was in complete shock and disbelief. And as I watched the news unfold, I let the news sink into my heart.
And not just you let it sink into your heart, you also let it sink into your brain. You joined the military, correct?
That's correct. I come from a long line of veterans. My father served in Vietnam and my grandfather in World War II. And I immediately felt that this would be a calling for my life.
The motivation for joining, though, how would you describe it?
I would describe it as strong, and I would describe it as, in my view, what I must have perceived it was like immediately after Pearl Harbor, and just the national spirit to maybe it was seek revenge or continue to defend our nation from future attacks. So whatever it was, some combination of that is what compelled me.
Looking back, Jason, was enlisting the right thing to do?
For myself, personally, absolutely. It is an experience that I would not have gained anywhere else in life. However, I'm not sure that my contributions to this cause ended up having the desired effect that I thought they would.
What was the desired effect when you enlisted after 9/11?
To stop terrorism and return our nation to peace. And I think here in 2016, we've not achieved that objective in the way I thought we would. I don't know that we're any better off than we were.
I'm just wondering if you have any other reflections as you look back on the last 15 years.
I'm saddened in a way. I have a 1-month-old daughter now, and I worry about her future and where we're heading with our nation. Specifically, our personal freedoms are much less than they were before 9/11, and that bothers me. And I just hope that we as a nation can find a way to promote peace and also promote personal freedom.
Jason, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
Jason Peterson decided to join the military after 9/11 and served in both Iraq and Afghanistan. We often turn to our online community of veterans to make sure we're telling the stories that matter to them. You can join by texting the word RETURN to 69866. That's RETURN to 69866. A follow-up now to a story we told you about a few months back, and it is a positive outcome. Elaine Harmon was a member of the Women Air Force Service Pilots, the famous WASPs. She died last year at the age of 95, and her family wanted her ashes laid to rest at Arlington National Cemetery. But the Army decided that WASPs were not entitled to have plots at Arlington. This past May, however, Congress passed a law allowing WASPs their place among the veterans at the cemetery. Elaine Harmon's granddaughter, Erin Miller, joins us now. What did it feel like to be at Arlington National Cemetery yesterday when those Air Force jets flew over in honor of your grandmother?
Yes, it was a great honor to be at Arlington National Cemetery to honor my grandmother, since it was her last wish to have her ashes laid to rest there. And it was kind of bringing closure to our family after this fight to ensure that she got her last wish along with all the WASPs, to be recognized at Arlington. And I know my grandmother would have been happy to know that this story is being shared, and in that way, more people will learn about the WASP and their history.
Remind us, Erin, what your grandmother, Elaine Harmon, did as a WASP. How risky were the missions she took in World War II?
Well, there were several missions. My grandmother, her job was to train men on instrument training. So she was stationed at Nellis Air Base after her WASP training was done. So she would fly in planes, and then there was two seats. The men would be in the one seat and not be able to see outside the airplane. So they had to learn to fly the plane without being able to see outside, just relying on their instruments. Mm. And she told me her job was to make sure they didn't crash into Mount Charleston.
Well, if she taught them right, I suppose they didn't
exactly,
do that.
Exactly, I guess.
Now, as you said, there were a few other WASPs in attendance there. You've got to be up there in years, but they look so great in their uniforms and everything. What struck you about these women?
Well, I've known these women for a little while now, and they were, all three of them actually knew my grandmother and were very, you know, close with her. And it's just nice to be with people who are friends with her, and they all have the same spirit that she did, you know, just feisty and, you know, life is for living and, you know, seize every opportunity type of thing. And they're very supportive of me and my family. They themselves traveled far to come to the funeral. So, you know, we're so honored that they could be there. And it's just nice to see them. And, you know, in the end of their, they won't be around much longer. So I appreciate spending time with them.
Yeah. Speaking of that fight, and I hope you don't think this question is weird, but I want you to tell us about the tattoo on your arm, because it is connected to your campaign to have your grandmother given a proper burial at Arlington.
The tattoo says HR 4336, 114th Congress, second session. So that is the bill number that Representative Martha McSally introduced in January to amend the original law, granting them veteran status. The amendment would make sure that the WASP were recognized at Arlington National Cemetery.
You must have gotten some sense from the WASPs who were with you yesterday that there's got to be some appreciation for this campaign and how they might be able to benefit.
Oh, yes. They're all very excited, and they all, you know, when they see me, they're just very glad and grateful for what I and the rest of my family have done and what Martha McSally did to fight for their honor and make sure that they're recognized. And as Schutze Reynolds told me, you know, we may not all want to be at Arlington, but it's the principle of the matter that our service is recognized equally as men who served.
Ms. Reynolds is one of the WASPs who was there?
Yes, she's from Pennsylvania.
Erin, I'm curious, do you think your grandmother helped inspire today's generation of female fighter pilots?
Yes, I absolutely know that she inspired them. And in fact, two of them spoke yesterday at the funeral, as well as Representative Martha McSally, who herself is a former Air Force fighter pilot. So they all give credit to the WASP for paving the way for their own service and inspired them to continue their journeys to be fighter pilots.
Erin Miller, the granddaughter of U.S. WASP pilot Elaine Harmon, whose ashes were laid to rest yesterday at Arlington National Cemetery. Thank you very much for being with us again.
Thank you so much.
A 10-year-old girl in Yemen asks the U.S. for help. You can hear why ahead here on The World. Our next story is about access to abortion in a country where it's been outlawed for decades. In Myanmar, abortion is illegal, except in limited cases when a woman's life is at risk. People who assist in illegal abortions there can face up to 3 years in prison. And for one doctor in Yangon, that meant facing a very personal dilemma. Here's our story from Shana Shealy in Yangon.
Dr. Susu Yin was doing surgical rounds at a Yangon hospital when her friend came to her with a problem. Yin's friend was pregnant and unmarried. She asked Yin for an abortion. Yin said no. Days later, she got a phone call from the same friend who said she had a bad stomach ache. So Yin went to her house.
When I go inside, I can smell the foul smelling. She lied to me. She lied to me.
Yin's friend had a near-fatal infection.
I think she went to that illegal clinic for abortion.
Yin took her friend to the hospital. She says doctors knew why her friend was there and treated her badly.
At the hospital, the medical professional is very ill-treatment.
While Yin's friend was recovering in the hospital, she didn't have a blanket to cover herself. Her family wouldn't bring one from home.
They said, like, the blanket will be smelly because of the abortion. My friends, we are very close friends.
And the friends brought a blanket and waited with her. But Yin didn't stay.
At the time, I didn't do like any supported things. I feel guilty.
Yin says she now thinks abortion should be legal in Myanmar.
The people who I consult said it is killing someone's life. That, because of the law, many women die.
But Mimi doesn't see it the same way. She's a 19-year-old English literature student in Yangon. She asked me not to use her last name.
Yeah, just no.
Because she says talking about sex is taboo in her culture.
This is something that is forbidden.
3 years ago, Mimi had a friend come to her in tears, pregnant.
She was still young. She still needed to get on with her university.
So she swallowed what Mimi calls Chinese medicine to induce an abortion.
I think later on, she's going to regret it because she just killed a life. This is not a small thing. This is not a simple thing. This is murder. In our tradition, Buddha says having this human life is like it only happened in once in a blue moon for everybody. So we shouldn't waste a life like this.
Most people in Myanmar are Theravada Buddhists with a belief that life starts at conception. Still, an estimated 250,000 Burmese women get illegal abortions each year. It's a leading cause of maternal deaths here. Women with enough money and the right connections can get safe abortions from trained medical practitioners, like Dr. Za. He opened an illegal clinic in downtown Yangon after he graduated from medical school. He says there are about 50 clinics like his in the city. If these clinics didn't exist, Za says women would have to rely on untrained providers who perform dangerous procedures. Saul wants people to know that a lot of young women are dying here because of unsafe abortions. He says he chose this career to save women's lives, but he admits that he makes a lot of money from his services, more, he says, than if he worked in a hospital. He charges up to $300 for an abortion. That's a lot of money in Myanmar, where people, on average, make less than $1,300 per year. And Za still struggles with his Buddhist values. He figures that even though he's ending a life, he's also saving one. Providing safe abortions, he says, is good and bad. It's a karmic balance, he says, one that he can live with. For the world, Shaina Shealy, Yangon.
We've been reporting on the war in Yemen for more than a year and a half. That war is still going on. And despite strong efforts from the United Nations, the warring parties are not talking right now. But a 10-year-old girl living in Yemen's capital is talking. Her name is Yara, and for 18 months now, she's been kept awake most nights by the sound of fighter jets, rockets, and bomb blasts. Last week, she decided it was time to do something. So she made a video.
I don't want it to be my turn to die. I want to live all my life. I want to be a doctor. I want to be an engineer. I want to grow up and be something important in this world. I wish.
Yara made that video in her bedroom with her mom's cell phone. After she was done recording, she told her parents about it. They helped her post the video online, and so far it's been viewed more than 20,000 times on Facebook. This week, we reached Yara on Skype.
I'm going to start with me. My name is Yara. I'm 10 years old. I study at Sana'a British School. I'm grade 6. I live in Sana'a, Yemen. And I have my mom and dad and two cousins and my brother and
my
aunt.
Hi! Hi! Listening!
They're all here.
Yara says she remembers when the airstrikes began at midnight, March 26, 2015. It was the night before what was supposed to be a big celebration at her school.
I was really excited because in our school, every end of term, we do like a concert, a big party. So I was really excited to attend the party, but unfortunately, war started.
Yara's school did not open the next morning. It would not open again for months. Families in Sana'a, the Yemeni capital, had to get used to living in a war zone.
We all slept in one room in the basement, and our backpacks were ready. They had money, our passports, even. We had our passports and our packs, even if we knew that we can't travel.
No travel because Sana'a's airport was closed, the seaports were blockaded, and the 1,000-mile border with Saudi Arabia was tightly controlled. So many Yemenis, including Yara, felt trapped inside their own country.
I was crying every day to tell my mom that I really want to travel, but she told me that, where will we go? Your dad can't work at any country because we're Yemenis. And the embassies are closed, so no visas. And the airport was shut.
It's still really hard to get out of Yemen. And as we said earlier, the war continues. To date, nearly 4,000 Yemeni civilians have been killed, mostly by airstrikes on rebel targets. According to the UN, more than 1,000 of those victims are children. Yara says it's impossible to ignore the violence.
And I want to tell you something. There is a mountain called Fajatan, and it's 3,000 meters away from us. They bombed it, and my bed shook while I was sleeping. My friend lost her mother and dad and brother. While she went to the shop to buy something, she came back and her house was wrecked, and her parents are dead.
Even as we spoke with Yara on Skype, we got a fresh reminder that there's a war going on around her.
Wait a second. I want you to concentrate because there's an airplane going on now. If you can hear it. That's like the jets, the sound of the jets. You know, before war, we used to hear the airplanes and try to go and catch them. And now when we hear the airplanes, we go and hide.
Wow, what some kids go through. Yara speaks Arabic, but she made her video message in English, she says, so people in the United States would understand. Yara thinks the U.S. holds the key to ending the war because Washington supports Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis have led the airstrike campaign in Yemen.
I want America to stop helping them so the war can end, and when my birthday comes, my wish is that war stops.
Yara turns 11 this December. You can watch her video. It's just 2 minutes long. At PRI.org. You're with The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. The governor of Texas has said he doesn't want Syrian refugees in his state, but some evangelicals say that's not very Christian.
We need to help, and we need to do something. It's worth facing some criticism for the sake of doing what Jesus has commanded us to do.
More on that story coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. America First, that's the bumper sticker version of Donald Trump's foreign policy. The Republican presidential nominee has said putting America first would mean closing the door to Muslims entering the United States. And for Trump, refugees from Syria pose a special risk. Many Republican governors agree. They've told the Obama administration they don't want people from Syria settling in their states. But the White House says it actually succeeded in meeting its goal of resettling 10,000 Syrian refugees here in the U.S. And one group that's been actively helping those refugees is evangelical Christians. We've got Pastor Bob Roberts from Northwood Church in Keller, Texas, on the line with us. So your state's governor, Greg Abbott, has kind of taken the lead on this, telling the White House that Texas didn't want Syrian refugees. What have people at your church been doing about that?
Well, our church has a huge ministry to refugees. We have for the past several years, and part of those refugees are Syrians. And it's sad because they just came from a war-torn area. They've been in refugee camps. They've been fearing for their lives. And they've come to Texas, and they're rather quiet because they know that they're not wanted, and they're somewhat fearful. But most of the ones that we've related to, if not all of them, are people who have legitimate concerns, and they care about their families, and they need help. And so we're helping them.
Do you and the Syrians there feel like you're surrounded by people who don't want you?
I would say the Syrians probably feel that way because of our media. But I would say that the majority of evangelical Christians, they do care about the refugees. Our church has been doing this for many years. And so they realize that you can't put a political sticker on everybody's back. And so it's worth facing some criticism for the sake of doing what Jesus has commanded us to do.
Well, there's some Christian leaders who follow the lead of Donald Trump on this. Reverend Franklin Graham, for example, he supports the ban on Muslims entering the U.S. How do other evangelicals respond when you say that Christians need to help Syrian refugees, all refugees?
I think maybe Franklin Graham missed Sunday school on that Sunday, because Jesus makes it very clear in Matthew 25 that we're supposed to love people to the degree that we feed them, we clothe them, we care for them. And loving takes a large risk with people. The risk, however, of being hard-hearted toward the rest of the world far outweighs the risk of somebody coming through that's going to create some other problems. Because the reality is the world is connected now. This idea that we live on little islands and we can keep everybody out, it's crazy. It's just not our world anymore.
Have you had a chance to speak with Governor Abbott in Texas about his position on refugees?
No, I haven't, but I disagree with him. I like my governor. I think he's a great man. I pray for him. I admire him. The reality is we're not letting in that many refugees to begin with. And contrary to what people say, I don't care who becomes the next president. We can tighten the way that we screen refugees, but it's already incredibly tight. Are there going to be people get through? Yes, there are always going to be people get through. You're never going to be able to foolproof a system, but you can't shut down everything. And here's the thing, we're not going to shut down everything. The problem is, in the meantime, all the harsh rhetoric creates an us against them mentality, an atmosphere of fear mongering, an atmosphere of xenophobia. And then when the rest of the world watches our media played out in America, they don't know what to make of us. And so the reality is the damage is done by the rhetoric, regardless of what ultimately happens. It's very problematic.
Pastor, let me ask you one final thing. As an evangelical, is one part of your agenda with refugees, Muslim refugees, to convert them to Christianity? Would that even be a fringe benefit for you?
Let me make it real clear to you. I want the whole world to know about Jesus. I would love for everybody to follow Jesus. But we have a saying in our church, and it's simply this: serve not to convert, serve because you're converted. And we can spend all our time trying to push religion down other people's throats, but I'm telling you, it's unhealthy. Do I want to see people follow Jesus? Yes. Am I going to help somebody if they say, no, I'm never going to follow Jesus? You bet I'm going to help them, because Jesus would help them. My commitment to loving other people is based on the fact that they are created in the image of God. And God said, love God and love others. And so I'm going to love others whether they follow my faith or not.
Pastor Bob Roberts with the Northwood Church in Keller, Texas. Thank you for your time today.
Hey, Marco, thank you very much.
Okay, picture this scene. A market in the city of Lahore, Pakistan. A group of young women walks past the stalls as male customers start staring at them and harassing them with catcalls. One woman stops in her tracks, throws off her headscarf, and begins a dance routine to Beyoncé's Run the World, Girls. Then five other women join her. It sounds like a movie, and in a way it is. It's actually a scene from an online marketing video for a Pakistani women's clothing company called Do Your Own Thing, and has taken Pakistan by storm. My colleague Shaima Khalil is a BBC Pakistan correspondent. So how often do you see spontaneous Beyoncé dance routines in the bazaars of Pakistan, Shaima?
Do you know, I kind of daydreamed about them, but no, I've not seen anything like this video in Lahore. And, you know, obviously, as you said, this was an online campaign of a clothing line, a small clothing line. But, you know, all joking aside, you know, this is Pakistan at the end of the day. And this is a society that is extremely sensitive about how women are portrayed, not just in the media, but in public in general. There's a lot of weight that comes with being a woman out in public. Your image says a lot about you, says a lot about how people interact with you. And I guess in a way, that's why this company wanted this to be a symbol for women's empowerment. But the backlash was almost immediate, Marco.
Yeah, well, it has taken Pakistan by storm, as I said, and it's not all good. I mean, what are the critics saying about this video?
Well, different people have different problems with it. So the feminist groups, for example, said, look, enough with the women empowerment message. You know, you're commercializing feminism, you're commercializing women's empowerment. Their criticism is that this particular ad shows, you know, conventionally attractive women, as they put it, that looked of a certain class, and it put them in a context that was meant to kind of vilify men of a lower class. There was an interesting, I'm just looking at an article from Dawn, a local newspaper, and the article put it as, you know, there was a sense of discomfort in the video, that they were surrounded by these men who were filming them. And it said there was a sense that they were watching caged animals in a zoo. On the other hand, though, some other women were saying, listen, feminism comes in all shapes and colors. It's not just about the serious issues. Actually, it's about daily lives. And the video does make a point about women's mobility, about their place in public space, and the fact that they have to put up with harassment. And that's the kind of dialogue that this video has generated. And, you know, like it or not, I think what you can agree on is that the PR stunt was on point with the clothing line, for sure.
How much of an issue is street harassment in Lahore, Pakistan, and Pakistan in general?
Well, you know, I've reported extensively in Egypt, for example, and I'm originally Egyptian. So if you compare and contrast those two countries, for example, Pakistan doesn't come close to what women in Egypt or India, for example, have to put up with. It is a very, very conservative society. And there is a level, and if you go to Lahore, and I've been there many, many times, I don't think that you get the physical harassment, but definitely you get the stares. And I think you've seen that in the video that, you know, as a woman walking in public space, especially on your own, you do get a lot of questioning stares about, you know, what you're doing here. I had a conversation with a group of women who've decided that they wanted to reclaim their own public space. And they decided that they wanted to go to the, you know, traditional cafes, tea houses, traditional tea houses that mainly are frequented by men. And when we were sitting around, I said, look, it actually feels quite uncomfortable because we're three women sitting among a sea of men and everybody's looking at us. And surely that makes you uncomfortable. Mm. And they said, but that's the thing that we have to fight. But you definitely feel that you're the odd one out. You definitely feel stared at and you're kind of like in a fishbowl almost.
So Shaima, given how polarizing this video has become, do you think it's the start of a larger conversation about harassment?
Do you know, I think the conversation has already started, if I'm really honest, because this is kind of the latest and like I said, the starkest example of women wanting their voices to be heard, wanting to be seen in public space. But for example, I remember also reporting on the Women's Rights Bill, and it was when a grand cleric, one of the most well-known clerics, came out and said that a husband can beat his wife lightly to kind of put her in her place. And at that time, you know, many, many women came out, especially on social media, and a hashtag started, try beating me lightly. And women were saying, well, I'd like to see you try beating me lightly and see what's going to happen. And so I think that these issues about harassment, about women's place in public spaces, whether it's markets or streets, is already starting, because I think that especially the younger women, women who go to college, women who go to universities and schools, are tired of the fact that they have to be tied down by a family member to go anywhere or to do anything. And they're also tired of, when they do this on their own, of being looked at oddly or of being harassed. So it is a conversation that is coming out in different ways, but definitely it's being had in a big way on social media.
My BBC colleague Shaima Khalil in Islamabad, Pakistan. Thanks as always, Shaima.
Always a pleasure.
Coming up in just a few minutes, the story of how 9/11 changed one young college student's life. It's one of a number of voices we're bringing you today and tomorrow ahead of the 15th anniversary of the attacks. Here's another, 21-year-old Nadia Spock, who interned here at The World over the summer.
I was 6 at the time of 9/11, and I remember being in school like any other day. We never really learned about it in school, but looking back on it, I wish that we had, just because I think in school there's such an emphasis on only learning about what's considered history and what was in the past. But that was such a monumental part of our childhood and our generation. And I think as children, we should have been able to know what was going on as it was unfolding. And I think the assumption was that we wouldn't be able to understand it. But now, you know, being 21 and realizing that the past of this event is still very relevant, I wish that it had been part of my education growing up, because as I can see now, it never really left.
How young people remember 9/11. That's tomorrow here on The World. If you're a Trekkie, you know. If you're not, you probably haven't been able to escape the news. Star Trek, the original TV show, turns 50 today. And to help me celebrate, I've got WGBH's Arun Roth with me. It goes without saying, Star Trek was huge in TV history. But for you, Arun, it was also huge personally. Tell us what you saw when you turned on the TV and Star Trek was there. How old were you?
I was probably, I might have been 5 years old by the first time that I watched Star Trek, and I fell in love with it completely. This would have been in the, you know, the mid-70s, so about 10 years after the show was actually on the air for the first time. But it was a huge part of my youth. I mean, it made a huge impact on me.
Why?
Well, the big part of it was the amazing diversity of the show. Now, The diversity of that cast, you know, the fact that it was sort of a rainbow coalition going out into space. There are Asians, Russians, white people, black people, all on the bridge of the Enterprise. But that's something that came important to me more sort of later. As a kid, I really related to Mr. Spock in this visceral way. And the reason, Marco, was because he was biracial, like me. You know, he was of two different cultures kind of being smashed together.
And later, as you grew up, you start to get a little more into the show, a little more granular, analyzing it. And I gather you see a comparison between Vulcans and Hindus. Explain.
That's true, Marco. Well, you know, something about, you know, the Vulcans, they have these intense mental disciplines, trying to control their feelings, not be at, you know, the control of their own appetites, which sounds an awful lot like Hindus to me. Sounds like you know, sort of classic yoga, the way that you try to control your appetites.
So the show and its various franchises, it became an international phenomenon. I remember hearing the daughter of Archbishop Desmond Tutu once talking about Star Trek Next Generation, and she brought up many of the same things you just said, the kind of rainbow nation in outer space. How widespread was this sense of the show?
I think it's pretty huge. I mean, I've talked to friends, you know, pretty much from all over the world, you know, people from Africa, from Asia. There is something powerful about seeing all of the different races of the world represented on the bridge of the Starship Enterprise. And you think about that, Marco, like when I was growing up and like going back to the mid-60s, leave aside science fiction, you didn't see any other show with that kind of racial diversity. Mm. Lieutenant Uhura, you know, played by Nichelle Nichols, she was actually the fourth in command of the Enterprise. Now, the network would not let them show a black woman in the captain's chair, believe it or not. This was 50 years ago. But think about that, Marco. 50 years ago, we had a black woman in charge, you know, in the command crew of our flagship Starship. And as a kid, you kind of take that for granted and don't realize how that works itself into your consciousness and how powerful that is to you.
Yeah, pretty revolutionary. So today, how do you get your original Star Trek fix? Do you have them all on DVD?
Well, they're all streaming on Netflix, and I've been turning my kids onto them as well, because Star Trek has these great kind of classic progressive values, you know, that you know, that the motto of the Vulcans is infinite diversity and infinite combinations, and what is more awesome and, you know, American than that?
So, Arun, I'm not sure I'm hipping you to this for the first time. Do you know about Mr. Spock's music from outer space?
I have heard some of that. Yes, I have.
Well, one of our dedicated vinyl crate diggers in the newsroom, engineer Mike Wilkins, dug out this old album. And yes, it is an album by Mr. Spock, not Leonard Nimoy. It's Mr. Spock's music from outer space. His music lives on. Arun Roth with our partners here at WGBH. Thank you for coming by.
Always a blast to discuss Star Trek, Marco. Thank you.
Music from Spock's Star Trek Lounge there. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We started the show today by speaking with two people whose lives were radically changed by 9/11. Two veterans who decided to join the military after the terrorist attacks 15 years ago. We're going to hear now about another life changed by 9/11, though in a very different way. Valerie Kaur grew up in a small farming town near Fresno, California. She's proud of her heritage and how her grandfather sailed by steamship from India to America in 1913, wearing a turban and beard as part of his Sikh faith. He faced race riots and laws that prevented him from becoming a citizen. But slowly his family put down roots, and his children and grandchildren felt at home in America. His granddaughter, Valerie Kaur, was 20 years old when 9/11 happened. She was shaken by the attacks and then shaken again when, days later, a family friend, Bulbir Singh Sodhi, was murdered.
Well, I remember watching the towers fall over and over again between images of a turbaned and bearded bin Laden. Within moments, I realized that our nation's new enemy looked like my grandfather, looked like my family. Like Sikh and Muslim Americans across the country, we saw an explosion of hate violence on city streets, people beaten, people stabbed, people shot at. And on September 15th, Bulbir Singh Sodhi, a Sikh man with a turban, was killed in front of his store. So he was a man I considered an uncle. Mm. And Balbir uncle was on his way to plant flowers in front of his store. He had gone to Costco that morning looking for an American flag to fly over his store. He emptied out his wallet to give everything he could at the checkout line to donate to the victims in New York City. When Frank Roque shot him, he shot him 4 times in the back that morning. And when he was arrested, he said that he was a patriot, they were arresting him while letting those terrorists go wild. So Balbir Singh Sodhi was really the first of dozens of people killed in hate crimes after 9/11. We think of the spot where he died as a sort of second ground zero, because it's the ground zero for all of the loss of life we've experienced here in the U.S., but also in the wars abroad in the years that have followed. We'll be there with the Sodhi family on September 15th in order to honor his life and all the people killed in the aftermath of 9/11.
And after his murder, did you realize pretty immediately that this was a big turning point for you personally?
I didn't understand that that moment would change my life and turn me into an activist. I only knew that my family was under attack, my country was under attack, and that I needed to do something, you know, anything.
What did you do?
I got in my car and crossed the country with my camera and began to document the stories of Sikh and Muslim Americans encountering hate with resilience and hope. And that became my first film, Divided We Fall. So really, 15 years later, I'm a filmmaker, lawyer, and entrepreneur activist today because of that initial moment, that decision to leap into the whirlwind in the aftermath of 9/11.
You went to all these cities across the U.S. in those weeks after 9/11. What did you see? What did you hear?
Well, I went, you know, from city to city, from home to home, from Gurdwara to mosque to temple, and I would arrive in places sometimes where the blood was still fresh on the ground. There were no investigative journalists. There were no police chiefs or mayors on the site working with the communities. There was just a few of us. There was me and my cousin, who was 20, holding a camera, trying to document it all. It was a time when the kind of tools that we see now, where our communities can tell our own stories, that, you know, there was no Facebook or YouTube or Twitter. We were relying on mass media, and we had just arrived at the moment where we could grab a consumer camera and start telling those stories ourselves. So this is the time we were in. And what I saw was, you know, looking into the eyes of these aunties and uncles, these families who had just been rocked by violence, was this deep loss of sense of belonging, this sense that they were not seen the way that they saw themselves, that in a moment they were seen as automatically suspect, you know, perpetually foreign, potentially terrorist in the eyes of their neighbors. And at the same time, I would see especially Sikh Americans reach into their faith for a way to respond.
There's also the story of somebody who was assaulted on a bus and people stepped in, right?
Yeah, a few weeks after 9/11, my Punjabi language professor, Professor Atamjeet Singh, was sitting on the bus when a man in the front of the bus saw his turban and beard, stood up, turned around, started pointing at him and yelling at him, "Hey, you terrorist, get off this bus, go back to your country, go back to where you belong." And my professor is quiet. You know, he's praying for the moment to pass. He's seen this moment over and over again. When the other people on the bus began to stand up and they told that man to sit down, the bus comes to a stop. My professor gets off the bus, and the man gets off the bus, and the man walks up to my professor and puts out his arm and shakes it.
Wow.
And says, "I am sorry. I lost my granddaughter in that second plane that went into that second tower. I am tired. I am angry." Incredible. You know, and what stayed with me about that story is not just the man's transformation. It's that transformation happened because of the people on that bus. So we are the people on that bus. And when we have love for people who don't look like us, love for people who disagree with us or even hurt us, then it can change a country.
Valerie, I'm curious to know how you see the moment we're in right now, a presidential campaign year with polarization feeling like the trend. Do you have a story or a vignette that kind of brings home where you think we're at today?
When I first made my film Divided We Fall after 9/11, I thought the film was going to document a brief chapter in U.S. history, an explosion of hate toward Muslim and Sikh Americans that would appear for a moment and then disappear. It was going to be a piece of archival history. You know, flash forward to today, and the Southern Poverty Law Center calls this last year the year of enormous rage. Our communities are five times more likely to be targets for violence than before 9/11. And so when the difference for me is that I am now a mother. I'm raising a brown boy who may someday wear a turban in a country that is actually more dangerous for him than the one that I inherited. The only thing that gives me hope is that I'm not alone in feeling tired. I think on the 15-year anniversary of 9/11, people are hungry. People are tired of responding to the latest mass shooting, tired of responding to the latest terrorism attack.
How does that make you feel as a filmmaker who's making films for change?
We have tools to tell our own stories. I mean, that's what's really different, right, compared to 15 years ago, that we can shape the narrative, that we're not just victims anymore, that we are not just bystanders anymore. I believe that this is the only way we can leave the next generation a country that is more just and loving than the one that we have today.
Interfaith activist Valerie Kaur, her first film, Divided We Fall, chronicles hate crimes in the aftermath of 9/11. Valerie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's our show today. You can find us online 24/7 at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back tomorrow. We'll see you then.
PRI, Public Radio International.